In the coming weeks, the chief has lined up a hot list of industry leaders from aviation to automobiles to find out exactly how we'll be getting from A to B when the world reopens and who'll be taking us there. So far, we've been joined by those with a more historic and established presence in the market, but looking to the future means innovation, and that requires new players too. On the precipice of a potentially radical disruption in the aviation market sits CEO and founder of Boom Supersonic, Blake Scholl. However, Boom aren't concerned with engineering anything brand new. Instead, they've tasked themselves with updating a form of travel that inexplicably dropped off the radar almost 20 years ago, at least in a civil context. In their view, the Concorde is due for a comeback. So what does the path to making a supersonic commercial flight look like? And why did it disappear in the first place? Well, joining me today from his office in Denver, Colorado, Scholl tells us why this wacky idea is not so crazy after all. In his view, it has the potential to make long-haul travel more sustainable, more accessible, and stress-free. We're listening. Are you? This is The Chiefs on Monocle 24, and I'm Tyler Brûlé. Blake, thank you very much for joining us. I guess we're talking at a time when the world is starting to open up. As part of the series, of course, we're talking to a variety of individuals who are involved in all aspects of transportation. Here you are. You've got a concept. You have a company. You have a wealth of investors who want to make the world go faster. Let's just kick off for those who aren't familiar. When you talk about what you are doing as an entity, how are you defining it?
At Boom, we are working to make supersonic travel mainstream, to make it easier for you and me and our friends and family and loved ones to get around the planet more easily. You know, we believe that fundamentally a planet which more people can go more often is a better place for us as humans. And so we're picking up where Concorde left off and building new generation supersonic aircraft that are faster, that are more affordable, that are more sustainable and more convenient than what we've had so far.
We'll come back to maybe some of the tricky questions that you might get, but I want to just jump into a very key element of all of this. Are you surprised that we are in a world where supersonic travel has disappeared for the layperson, or certainly for the civilian? Of course, there are lots of sonic booms happening all the time in a military context, but that we've had this, you know, we're talking about, you know, not just a few years here, we're talking about almost a generational gap now where we have not had supersonic flight. And I'm wondering, does that surprise you somehow?
Totally. I think on the face of it, it's incredibly bizarre, because in most areas of technology, we make wonderful progress. If you think about what's possible now with e-commerce and the internet and communications, and you know, we've got electric cars that are becoming mainstream, and we've made all this progress in a whole bunch of areas, and life keeps getting better. But if you look in aerospace, it's a different story and a much, you know, much more concerning one. In 1969, you know, more than 50 years now, we put a man on the moon for the first time, brought him back safely. And that same year, we flew Concorde for the first time. But fast forward more than half a century, and if you want a supersonic airliner or a lunar lander, you don't look up into the skies. You have to go to a museum. And I think that's kind of crazy. We've regressed. We lost our way on making the future better. And it's important that we understand why and that we turn that around and that we begin to make amazing things possible and travel again.
Now, of course, many people listening to this will think, wacky idea, because we're in a moment of, and maybe an extended moment. If we think going into the pandemic, there were a lot of people who were flight shamers. They were standing outside of airports and asking people, you know, why were they, you know, flying off on holidays when they could be taking the train? And of course, we know how the story goes. Now we're in a position as well where we're hopefully coming out of this pandemic, but still also we have individuals who are asking, well, maybe this was a good reset. We're coming into an era when we realize that travel, you know, counter to what you're saying, is not necessarily a force for good. And we're able to sit at home and work. And of course, you know, we should take a more considered view when we want to fly. Now, I think people will maybe know what Monocle's view is on that. Of course, we believe very much that the world does need to go around at various speeds and we need to be considerate, but also we're better when we're face to face. We're better when we're experiencing things in person. What are your rebuttals to a lot of those things that you must be hearing at the moment?
So first off, it's a totally valid question, and I'm glad people are asking it. You know, when I talk about our vision and we talk about flights that are faster and more affordable, what that's going to mean is not less travel, but actually a lot more interest in traveling. And you know, and right now, you know, aviation is kind of a percent or two of global CO2. Of course, we want that to go down. But if we have more travel and you don't change the sustainability profile, it's going to head in the wrong direction. And that's why we need to build the next generation of travel that's not just more appealing in terms of being faster and more convenient, but we also have to make a big leap in sustainability. And I look at Tesla as a really good leading example of how to do this right. You know, if you think about electric vehicles before Tesla, you know, they were slow, they didn't have much range, you know, they weren't sexy. You got one because you really wanted to do the right thing for the planet. And then the thing that Tesla did that really accelerated the adoption of sustainable transport was to build a car that was both more sustainable and way more attractive to customers. And so we need to do the same thing in aviation. And for what that means for us is let's build the best passenger experience on an airplane that's twice as fast, and let's make it run on 100% alternative fuels so it can completely be carbon neutral end to end. And we can double click on how that works and why Overture is going to be the very first commercial airplane that does this. And at the same time, we need to think about noise and Contra Concorde, which is rip-roaring loud. Overture is going to be as quiet or quieter than the airplanes flying today. So you can have, it turns out you can have all the things. You can have faster, more convenient, more affordable, and more sustainable. And if you think long enough out into the future, you know, imagine yourself in the year kind of 2050 looking backwards. You know, do you really want humanity to have made the decision that, well, there's some challenges with transportation and sustainability, and so we just decided to kind of hang it up and do more Zoom calls? Or do you want us to have shown up to those challenges, innovated, made breakthroughs, and found a way to continue to have more of the things that make life on Earth great while continuing to take even better care of the planet?
Let's come back to a potential order book and certainly a customer profile. But maybe we have to just talk through the Concorde experience, the space that that Concorde occupied. This was an aircraft that was the flagship for Air France. It was the flagship for British Airways. It served such a unique position. It was, of course, the aircraft connecting the world's most important cities at that time, really in record time. And as you said, it's incredible that we've taken a step back. It was noisy, as you said. Of course, there was a tragic accident after takeoff from Charles de Gaulle, which, of course, grounded it. Nevertheless, this was flying. This was just so remarkable. The rumble as you went down the runway. Talk us through what this experience will be like. Romance the listener a little bit in terms of size, scale, and what people will experience on Overture.
If you think about the travel experience that we have today, it is stressful from start to finish. And you know, and it just drives our cortisol up. It's not healthy. And what we really want is the complete opposite of that, where the travel ecosystem itself, it fades into the background. It becomes a thing that you can do effortlessly, that the experience is tranquil and calming and even delightful. And to really get there, there's a lot that we have to improve. And of course, at Boom, we're starting with just the airplane itself, and we hope to inspire improvement kind of in the ecosystem around us. But we are, you know, we're sweating the details, and I'll talk about some kind of features of Overture that passengers will enjoy, and kind of how they contrast with Concorde, which was this, you know, remarkable technical achievement, but too expensive and honestly not a super great customer experience. So when you step on board Overture, first off, you step into the widest, largest point of the airplane. So you're going to have this open space. It's a relatively small airplane overall, but it's going to actually feel quite spacious. You could stand up in it. There's going to be headroom. We're looking at options to completely get rid of overhead bins, which makes the cabin feel much, much airier, more open. There is, on one side of the aisle, there are two seats. On the other side, there's one. So if you're traveling by yourself and you want to have your own space, you don't have to choose between window seat and aisle seat. You can have both. And if you're traveling with somebody that you like, you can sit next to them. And then within the passenger space, we're designing these large expansive windows. It's flying fast at 60,000 feet. You can actually see the curvature of the Earth. The sky is a deeper blue. It's going to be a gorgeous view out that window. And then your personal space is about it's about giving you what you want, whether you want to relax or work or be entertained or dine. So it's a wide seat. It's got five different ergonomic positions. There's a 25-inch screen in every seat. You can watch a movie on it, or you can dock your laptop to it, and it's like a supersonic flying desk in the sky. Of course, there's a great space to kind of fold out a table and dine. And my personal favorite feature is there's a cup holder that is nowhere close to where you'd put your laptop. That would have saved me a couple times. I'm proud that we're working with just some of the best design minds on the planet to make this wonderful. But if I go kind of back and up a level for a moment, and again, contrast with Concord. So on Concord, it was just such a rare and magical thing to go supersonic that it was a big deal and it was celebrated. And so there was a big speedometer in the cabin. And when you'd go through the sound barrier, the crew would celebrate. They'd come around with champagne and have toasts and everyone would cheer. It was this very momentous kind of rare and special thing to be going faster than the sound barrier. And, you know, I think people are going to be tremendously excited to break the sound barrier on Overture. But we'll know that we've won when passengers now find this annoying because high-speed travel is routine and they just want to be left alone to read their book or do email or finish their movie.
Yeah, I agree with you up to a point. But also, I would say that there was a magic. What you're also saying, though, in a curious way, though, is on one side, you're talking about sort of romance and a lot of things that are going to happen around this. But I think seeing the speedometer at the front at a time when actually there's very little to celebrate in travel at the moment, I would hope at least if I was buying the aircraft from my airline, I think this marking of something which has so rarely happened is somewhat interesting. I mean, everyone's already clattering away on their laptops at the moment anyway and not paying attention to anybody. So I don't know. I just, to me, don't you want to somehow also celebrate the achievement and not make it mundane? What's the point of doing the project?
I think there's this really interesting duality here, isn't there? Because, you know, on one hand, there is so much that's amazing and romantic and beautiful about flight, especially like boundary pushing, like envelope stretching, supersonic flight. That is, you know, for me, it speaks to me tremendously emotionally. Like when I fly in an airplane, I'm always in the window seat. And I'm glued to the window and I'm looking down and I'm thinking, how marvelous is it that you can take in this view of the planet that, you know, honestly, no bird could ever have, no human was ever really meant to have. And you can look down and you can see the beauty of the planet. You can take it in with this view that you couldn't have any other way. And I find it incredibly inspiring. And, you know, a certain part of me wants to say, you know, and we should all be amazed every single moment we're ever flying. On the other hand, when technology is really serving us the best, we get to be excited about it at first, and then it just becomes normal. For example, think about what we have on our phones today and how not that long ago, you know, it was so amazing that there was an iPhone and you could play a movie on it or browse the web. And we were all, you know, kind of in awe and shock of that. And now it's become part of how we live. And I think that normalization is part of technology really fully coming to fruition and having all of its impact. So if I think about the future and how I would love for it to be, for those of us who are, I'll just call it romantics, Tyler, you and I, like we should totally be able to appreciate this. And there should be features of the experience that reinforce that. But for, you know, what I wish for, you know, my kids and what I wish for, you know, billions of people on the planet is they don't have to think about it. They get to enjoy it. They get to benefit from it. And it should be a delightful experience. It should definitely not be the dreadful thing that we have today. But it need not be this thing that you celebrate every time. That's the intention with it just not being normal.
Just coming back to, I don't want to be the bully interviewer, but you talk about billions, and I'm no airline CEO, but I've worked with enough airlines in my time to know that, of course, this is still going to be a flagship. This is not an Embraer 145 that you've souped up and made it go faster. This is something which, of course, it's not going to be sort of a basic utility tool, unless you tell me otherwise. But I would imagine that it's going to come with a premium. And also because there is a certain set of people in industry and government, you know, wherever they may, who do have to get places quickly. And this is going to obviously provide that service. Or is it going to do the job of what an A330 does as well, just faster, and I can buy my ticket at the same price?
So it's a great question. And it's a matter of where does this start and where does it go? And, you know, Concorde, as you know, was this like super, super premium, like $20,000 a ticket, you know, affordable for only a tiny number of people and, you know, a very, very tiny number of people on a routine basis. And Overture is about 75% less expensive to operate than Concorde was. So that $20,000 ticket can drop down to about five, about what you'd pay in business class today. Now, of course, probably a lot of the folks listening are like, well, five grand, that's still pretty, you know, that's not what I pay in economy on an, you know, A330. And this is where there's really a roadmap. And if you think about a lot of the other technologies and breakthroughs and how they kind of come to be available, it's very common and normal that things start at a higher price point. And then as we kind of figure it out, we get economies of scale, we find efficiencies, the costs come down. We've stumbled in our implementation of this in flying, but my job at Boom is to stop stumbling and get us back on path. So Overture is an airplane that is affordable to tens of millions of people who fly business class today. But there's going to be Overture 2 and Overture 3. And what you're going to find is that we progressively make the aircraft faster, bigger, more efficient, and more affordable. And my aspiration is to make the fastest flight also the most affordable, and ultimately get to a place where you can get anywhere in the world in 4 hours for $100. And you don't get there overnight. You have to work at it incrementally. You don't have to break the laws of physics to do it. It's all possible. And to give you a little bit of an insight about, you know, I imagine some people's brains explode. That sounds crazy. How can we possibly do this? But I find it helpful to remember that in a certain aspect, we've already done it. We went from props to jets in the 1950s. And, you know, the initial jet aircraft were not more efficient than the propeller aircraft at the time. But they got optimized over time. And this interesting effect kicked in that I call the speed dividend. You know, when you go faster, the core sort of energy efficiency of the machine is the big thing you have to work on. However, the faster you go, the more flights you can do with the same airplane, the more flights you can do with the same crew. You don't even have to spend as much on food because you don't eat or drink as much on a 3-hour flight as you do on a 7-hour flight. And so that's the speed dividend. You go faster, a lot of the costs actually drop. And so when you make enough progress on energy efficiency, it turns out that you go past this tipping point where the speed dividend is what dominates and the faster flights, actually the more affordable one. And I think that's where there's something for really all of us to be really excited about.
Some people would be listening to this maybe on the investment side, and it's a vogue today to talk about whatever you develop needs to be for everybody. A lot of other people would say, well, actually, no, maybe you just need to focus and you're not building, Dassault is not developing a next generation of private jet for everybody. So is there a case to be made if I was sitting around, if I was one of your investors, to be saying, you know, maybe it makes sense right now, Blake, just to focus on this and let's not try to be all embracing because that's the vogue today?
You know, I don't think there's, maybe this is controversial, I don't think there's anything wrong with private jets. I think for the people who can afford them, it's great that they have them. I think they help businesses. The world actually is better with them. But that's not what Boom is here for. Long before I started Boom, you know, I was watching the supersonic space. Like in my mid-20s, I was working at an internet startup in Seattle. And my then girlfriend was one of these horrifically delayed flights. And I'm sitting there waiting for her. And that was the first time I really started thinking about supersonic. I was thinking, like, how much better would our lives been if, you know, my girlfriend had been able to arrive here at Mach 2? And that day I put a Google alert on the supersonic jet because I wanted to find out when I could go buy a ticket. And, you know, and for the better part of a decade, it was just, you know, crickets, like nothing credible. Some talk of a supersonic private jet. And it's like, great, if I've got $120 million, then maybe I can go faster. But I didn't have $120 million. I didn't see myself ever having $120 million. And so, you know, I feel very driven to solve these problems in the very largest scale way possible. And I think there are real benefits to this. You know, for example, before jets, Hawaii was not a tourist destination. Like nobody went there. It took too long. And thanks to the speed of the jet, we would have millions of people who can have an island vacation. Sports, again, this is a little bit of a North American example. But prior to the jet, major league sports, football, baseball, were confined to the northeastern United States because you had to put the teams within where they could travel in a day. And then when the jet came along, a sport spread coast to coast in the U.S. And you think another step forward, what's going to be the next thing? What happens when we can get to Australia as easily as we can get to Hawaii today? And you know, what other things will happen that we can't even, you know, that you and I sitting here today using our imagination, we can't even think of? But somebody who's going to find that when the world, when it's easier to get around, new things become possible. And those things have their own benefits and effects. And lots of this is possible only because you make it widely available. And so I deeply believe it's really important. I deeply believe if you go after creating the most value for the most people, one, you can be incredibly motivated. Two, you can attract great people who are going to come and help you do it. And three, like ironically, ultimately, that's how you create the most business success.
I'm just reflecting on what you've been saying. Why are we here? Well, many of us are stationary at the moment, given the way the world's been. But why are we subsonic? Because too much engineer attention get diverted to Silicon Valley, because there's no reason. There's no reason why we should be in this position. But of course, there are only so many engineers to go around. What happened? It's really making me think there's something curious at play as to why supersonic went away.
It's a brilliant question, and I think there's some deep lessons to be learned from really examining that closely. Like I said, in space and in aviation are really the two areas where we've regressed. And so what happened? And so if you look back at the early history of aviation and say, where did progress come from? Going all the way back to the Wright brothers and the first airplane, we had some bicycle entrepreneurs who thought they could build something, and they thought there could be some applications for it. And they were excited to invent, and they were excited to commercialize. And the same thing goes with the early airliners. You know, Douglas built the DC-3, which is the first kind of really successful large market airliner, because he thought he could build something that passengers could afford to fly on in large numbers, that airlines could operate profitably, and he knew he could make money selling them. And so he had to go do something that made sense for him and his investors, and it made sense for passengers, and it made sense for airlines. In a certain sense, it had to be sustainable economically. And so that commercial motivation, I think, is actually really key. Now, if you contrast that with what happened with Concorde, so Concorde wasn't built by a startup, or it wasn't even built by an established company. This was a joint venture between the French and British governments. It was established by treaty in 1962. And what was the point? The point was, it was the height of the Cold War, and we wanted to show that Western technology could do something that Soviets couldn't do. And so Concorde had really a couple goals. It was, you know, fly fast, try not to crash, and do it faster than the Russians do it. And so they didn't think about the economics. They didn't think about who's going to be able to afford to fly it. They didn't think about, is this going to make sense for enough airlines on the planet? They didn't think about how to make it environmentally sustainable. It was all about national prestige. And if you look at Apollo, you know, which is, you know, it, technologically, it is so inspiring. But we went to the moon, we planted a flag, and then we didn't know what to do next. And so the national prestige-driven innovation can soak up an enormous amount of great engineering talent. It can produce amazing and awe-inspiring innovations, but it's not a bridge to sustainable progress. It looks like progress, but it's an illusion. And it's an illusion because there is no commercial roadmap that brings it to people. And I think and if you look at the political fallout of Concorde, you know, the Europeans had Concorde. In the US, we had a would-be Concorde competitor until it got canceled by Congress. And then, you know, once we didn't have it and the Europeans had it, we're like, well, we can't have any of that sonic stuff. And we started putting speed limits in place and trying to block Concorde. And it got all bollocked up. And there's still like regulations that were like national prestige driven to block Concorde. And they're still on the books, and they're still making it harder to actually innovate. And so the point of all of this is innovation, not all innovation is created equal. And durable, sustainable innovation that impacts more and more and more people needs to have a commercial motivation.
Blake, we almost have to go. But two outstanding questions. First, why isn't Dassault doing this? Why isn't Boeing doing it? Why isn't Airbus doing it? Why isn't Mitsubishi doing it? Why isn't Embraer doing it? Why don't we see another program that matches what you're doing right now?
It's a fascinating question. People often ask, so this is a good idea. Why isn't Boeing doing it? So I invite you to put yourself in the shoes of the Boeing CEO or the Airbus CEO for a moment. And, you know, forget about the 737 MAX debacle. Forget about COVID. Those things will all go away over time. You know, you build one new clean sheet airplane about every 10 to 15 years. Just look over history and you go, you know, how long from the 757 to the 767 to the 777, the 787, and so forth. You know, they get to pick one of these kind of every decade to decade and a half. And so the business motivation there is, you want to go after the biggest market possible. And the last thing you want to go do is build a product that's going to undermine the sales of something that's currently a cash cow. So Overture, remember that while long-term we're going to get this to be something that everyone can fly, Overture right now is going to take the very profitable passengers that fly front cabin, you know, in a 787 or an A350 today and move them over into a supersonic jet instead. And so the result of that is that the 787s and A350s become, you know, we need less of them and they become less valuable. And so, you know, if you're the CEO of Boeing, you could do that, or you could build a replacement for the 757s that you don't make anymore that are now rusty in service and airlines want something new that's kind of like that. And you could sell, you know, four times as much and you don't undermine any other product line. You know, if you go to your board and you say, well, I want to do supersonic, you're not the CEO for very long. So that large companies have to go after the biggest opportunity with the least risk. And what that naturally does is it creates a place for that new entrants play. And supersonic is something that has to come from a new entrant because of that dynamic. And there's a great book written on this called The Innovator's Dilemma. And it talks about, you know, specifically what disruptive innovation is. And when you understand that dynamic, you can see why Boeing, technically, they could choose to focus on this, but they won't because their commercial motivation is elsewhere. That's the role that startups play. They come in and they find these things that are not, you know, they don't start out big enough or attractive enough to the big players. They started a little bit more nichey, but then they get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's the real opportunity that I see here to create what ultimately I think will be the third large aircraft manufacturer. So it'll be Boom, Boeing, and Airbus that are the big three.
Just before we go, just with your, maybe with a bit of sparkle dust and dreaming, and we should state Japan Airlines is an investor in Boom. What you think about the first air show, when there's the grand unveiling and all of the world is there to see this, and also, as often happens at air shows as well, you announce your order book. Who's your dream? Who is your launch customer?
So I'll start by talking about, you know, what we've got already. So Japan Airlines threw in with us actually several years ago, and it's something I'm immensely grateful for, because as you're inventing the future, you know, it can be lonely and you need people to throw in with you, even when there's still uncertainty and risk. And Japan Airlines was willing to do that. They invest in the company. They pre-ordered 20 Overture aircraft, which is $4 billion in airplanes. And frankly, before Boom had built much of anything. And then they've worked with us, you know, hand in hand to refine the airplane to make sure that it's not just this headline feature of speed, but the passenger experience is great. And pilots can learn to fly it relatively easily and it can be serviced well on the ground and it's going to be reliable. And, you know, and I think down the road, there are these visionary lead customers, and then they're also going to be sort of mainstream follower airline customers. And, you know, I think ultimately this is something that every international airline is going to need to have part of their fleet.
I have to interrupt you here. You have to answer the question. I know it's difficult. I know you have to be nice to everybody. I know that Japan Airlines is an investor, but we're at the Paris Air Show at Le Bourget. Who are you excited to announce?
I would love it if we had one airline in every major market standing next to us. So, you know, it could be a Lufthansa in the middle of Europe. It could be British Airways, which would be poignant because they operated Concorde. It could be Qantas out of Australia. And we were able to stand up there and say, this is something that the whole world is doing. That would be my magic moment.
My thanks to Blake Scholl, CEO of Boom Supersonic, for joining us for this week's episode of The Chiefs. And tune in next week as we look beyond those getting us from A to B and to those shaping the experience when we get there. This episode of The Chiefs was produced and researched by Paige Reynolds and edited by Steph Chungu with assistance from Desiree Bentley. I'm Tyler Brulé in Zurich. Thanks very much for listening.